Abdul Qadir Khan was put under house arrest in 2004 after he admitted to selling nuclear secrets to Libya, Iran, and North Korea. But late last week, a Pakistani court ordered his release. Joining me now to explain the ramifications of Khan's release is David Albright, president of the Institute for Science and International Security and a former nuclear weapons inspector. I'm very pleased to welcome him to today's second underreported segment. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. A.Q. Khan seems to be okay as well. I mean, here's this man who helped make Pakistan a nuclear power, and that seemed to have made him a hero in many Pakistanis' eyes.
No, he's a national hero in Pakistan. In fact, much of the public of Pakistan doesn't believe he did anything wrong. And in fact, they don't believe he provided items to Iran, North Korea, or Libya.
They just simply deny what he has already admitted to?
Well, he now actively tries to deny what he did and says he was coerced into confessing. So he's spending a lot of time trying to revise history and protect his legacy as a Pakistani hero. And yet revelations continue to come out. One last summer, in fact, that we were involved in releasing part of it, was that he leaked or was trying to sell off nuclear weapons designs that are smaller than what had been previously known to perhaps in the future to Libya, Iran, who knows. And these designs would have been stolen from the Pakistani nuclear arsenal. And he, of course, very, very much denies it, but the designs were found on some computers in Switzerland and Dubai, and the computers were owned by important members of the Khan network. And so they were looking at drawings of these designs, and as best as we can figure, they were starting to put together a set of what we call a second wave of assistance to countries like Libya, where, you know, first we'll help you enrich uranium, be able to get the nuclear explosive material, then we'll come back in and offer you the ability and the tools to make the nuclear weapon itself that would fit on your ballistic missiles. And so countries like Libya, Iran, they need miniaturized nuclear weapons designs. And so it looks like Khan was pilfering his own country's nuclear arsenal to get the designs to then be able to create sort of a package of assistance that would then help a country actually make a nuclear weapon and short-circuit all the difficulties of doing so.
And he was doing that while he was under house arrest?
Well, he was doing that before he was arrested. This goes back into the early 2000s. He didn't do very much during house arrest. I mean, he talked often to journalists, particularly as over the last year the restrictions have loosened on him. They're certainly worried that if he is actually released and doesn't have many constraints on his activities, that he could actually perhaps do some of these activities again on a reduced scale. I don't think he could put together the kind of network he originally put together. But there's worry that he could sell off some of these things, because finally, in a sense, the busting up of the Khan network has gone much better than the rounding up of the perpetrators and all the assets. And so you don't really know for sure where all the nuclear weapons designs are. Khan may still have access to some of them. His associates may have access. If he's released and Pakistan doesn't, in a sense, put him back under house arrest, he may connect with those people. It won't be obvious how he'll do it. He's very good at communication. He's very good at hiding things. And so there is a worry that he remains a proliferation risk.
And isn't there a suggestion that he has been aided in all of this by the Inter-Services Intelligence Organization of Pakistan?
Well, that part is very murky. It's, in a sense, Khan's friends say it was all done by the government of Pakistan. And that, you know, anything that went to Libya was ordered by former President Musharraf. And so they've tried to cast blame on the government. The truth is extremely difficult to figure out. There had to have been people in the government that knew what Khan was doing. I would imagine some profited from it. In the case of Libya, it's very hard to find any evidence of actual Pakistani government involvement. In the case of North Korea, it has to have been Pakistani government involvement. At the very highest levels, if not authorizing the transfer, at least setting up the mechanisms that made it inevitable. In other cases, it's murky. In Iran, it looks like the cooperation that started in the 1980s probably had Pakistani government approval. When Khan picked up the activities in the mid-90s, it's not so clear. So and part of the reason for this murkiness is that Khan was a very powerful figure. He was the head of a major part of their nuclear weapons effort. He had control of budgets. He had tremendous amount of authority. He was charged, in fact, go out and steal, beg, or borrow anything you need to make nuclear weapons in Pakistan. So his agents were very active, breaking the laws of European countries, American our laws, to get the wherewithal to make Pakistani nuclear weapons. And so he, in that sense, the Pakistani government has always endorsed smuggling. What Khan did is took it a step further. Money was good. He's never been very sympathetic to the West, and he saw an opportunity to make a lot of money and arm, in essence, some of our enemies.
And even though he was under house arrest for 5 years, he was never charged, and he was praised by Musharraf. Musharraf pardoned him and praised him. So I'm not sure whether he did that because he was implicated in what Khan was doing, or whether it would have been politically damaging if he had condemned Khan's actions too forcefully, because Khan was so popular as the father of the Pakistani nuclear program.
Yeah, and certainly the latter's true. I mean, there's always been these rumors that maybe Khan had something on Musharraf, and that was partly why Musharraf held back. And Musharraf also held back on the others. I mean, there were about a dozen Pakistanis that were picked up with Khan and that were actively working on this proliferation network, and they've never come to trial either, and were released from house arrest even earlier than Khan. And so there remains a worry that Pakistan as a government and also as a society does not take this crime very seriously, and that actually increases the worry that it'll happen again.
Now, why did you say that the Pakistani government was involved with the sale to North Korea? Why North Korea, not necessarily Libya and possibly Iran? Libya, by the way, which has abandoned its nuclear program, but for other reasons.
Well, one is that North Korea military industries and Khan's laboratory, it was called AQ Khan Laboratories in the 80s, had close cooperation on military or conventional weaponry. And one of the things that Khan needed was a missile that could deliver the nuclear weapon. And he and others in North Korea, including Benazir Bhutto, who was prime minister at the time in the early 90s, went to North Korea and, in essence, got that technology, got rocket components. And so in that process, Khan had established relationships with the North Koreans. And at some point, Khan and his people sold North Korea several centrifuge designs, and other information and items you need to start to put together a centrifuge R&D program. So they were very close together. And the Pakistani government, I mean, senior officials in 2001 admitted to me that you know, North Koreans were at AQ Khan Laboratories. They denied that they had anything to do with centrifuge, but it's you just can't believe that that's not going on.
So this is cut across various governments in Pakistan, Benazir Bhutto, Musharraf. What has Khan's relationship been with the new president, Asif Ali Zardari? Has Zardari praised him?
No, I don't think so, and I don't know what his relationship. I mean, I think that right now the Pakistani government isn't happy with Khan's ability to manipulate the Pakistani public, the media, to kind of rejuvenate his image. I mean, and he's been under orders, even under these loosened restrictions that were in place before the court case, that he couldn't communicate with journalists. I mean, he would sort of, there would be kind of an explosion of words from Khan out to the media, self-serving, that then would embarrass the Pakistani government. And they said, okay, you know, you can't do it. In December, he did it again. But what did he do? He used his wife's email. And so the journalists, in this case, they were in Switzerland, would email questions to Khan. And then through his wife's email, he would then answer those questions. And they're printed in English, in Swiss publications. And so he's very hard to control, and I think the Pakistani government doesn't really know what to do with him, and I think they're determined to try to keep him under control, but I don't think it's easy to do, and I'm not very optimistic that they can actually do it, and that's why I worry that he could be remain a proliferation risk, because another part of the network is that they were selling centrifuges, these fast rotating cylinders that are inside metal that then enrich uranium, and they were making thousands and thousands of components. Not all the components have been found, and there were sample centrifuges that they, in a sense, they were salesmen. They would go out to a country and, you know, here's what we're offering you, and they'd give them a sample. Not all those have been accounted for, and so there is a worry that Khan could also kind of have a fire sale of the remaining inventory. And work with his associates. And it's very hard to control the kinds of communications that they would undertake. You know, you can say, okay, he's watched, but you can't watch him 24 hours a day. You can't keep him from communicating with using modern technology. It's just too hard to do. And so there is a worry that despite the restrictions that he'll be able to do some things that are certainly raise proliferation risks.
My guest is David Albright, president of the Institute for Science and International Security, a former nuclear weapons inspector. The Pakistan's lawyers who were in conflict with Pervez Musharraf have been very supportive of Khan. Why is Khan's release linked in their minds with the restoration of Justice Iftikhar Muhammad Chowdhury and some of the other judges that Musharraf dismissed?
Well, Pakistan's laws are pretty nebulous and contradictory. Musharraf used his powers to contain or incarcerate Khan in his house, and again he's arrested, interrogated, and then pardoned, and then put under house arrest. So I mean, there's things happening in Pakistan that couldn't possibly happen here, and that, in fact, that's part of the problem. Khan should have been brought to trial, and the evidence presented, and then he should have been subjected to the rule of a court. And so these things don't work well in Pakistan. And so there's a lot of ad hoc nature, and then of course there's a lot of revision. And so I think Khan's benefiting from the pendulum swinging back to saying, look, laws have to have some meaning, and courts have to have some meaning. And Khan's and his lawyers are right there to exploit this swinging pendulum. So I think it's a very big embarrassment for the Pakistani government, and he's a very difficult person for them to control.
Is the international community leaving it up to Pakistan to keep tabs on Khan?
No, certainly not. But it's primarily up to Pakistan. But others will other countries will be trying to keep tabs on him. But it's just very hard to do, and it's much better if he's just under house arrest, or I would prefer in prison. Given what he's done, I mean, he was selling the wherewithal to make nuclear weapons to countries like Iran that may use them someday.
Well, what's happened to his network during his 5 years of house arrest? Has it fallen apart?
Well, the network was truly busted up, and many were arrested at least at the top level. I mean, if there's, you know, 3, 4, 5 levels in an organization like that or a network like that, you know, the top 1 and 2 and part of the third were rounded up.
That was after a ship bound for Libya was found to be loaded with machine parts used to make enriched uranium in 2003.
That's right. And so there were many arrests in 2004 and 5. Unfortunately, the penalties have been very light.
But this is an international matter. Can't other countries get involved, or would they have to go into Pakistan and snatch him?
Well, what's one of the unfortunate things that's turned up or its fallout of the Khan network busts is that national prosecutions don't do well at prosecuting transnational crimes. I mean, there's a real need to look at this whole issue. And from my point of view, what Khan did is a crime against humanity, and it requires international arrangements and agreements to make it easier to detect that activity and prosecute it when you catch it. Right now, what happens is national judicial systems are left to use their national laws to try to prosecute these crimes, and yet someone being tried in Switzerland may have committed things in Malaysia, and so then they need witnesses from Malaysia They need other members of the network to testify. Well, Malaysia doesn't like to do that. Pakistan is completely uncooperative about for prosecutors to get evidence from Pakistanis. And so you have a situation where the smugglers have a tremendous advantage, and they're beating the prosecutions.
Richard, go ahead.
Yeah, and or they're getting very light sentences.
Richard Holbrooke, the U.S. Special Envoy to Pakistan and Afghanistan, was in Islamabad this week. You think that played a role in the timing of Khan's release? You think that Pakistan was trying to send a kind of message that it was asserting its independence from the United States?
No. I think the court was acting independently. This court case has been perking along for a long time. Khan's been very determined to get out, and he has some very important allies. And as I said, he's exploiting the judicial system in Pakistan for his own benefit. And I think that this release was expected. And again, over the last year, the conditions on his house arrest have been reduced. Now, again, it's Pakistan, and so what the United States has asked for, and I would support, is that very robust conditions be created that make it hard for him to do anything, restrict his visitors, restrict his motion, in a sense, some kind of new house arrest. Now, hard to see if that's going to happen yet, but I think that's what the U.S. has been pushing for, and I imagine that's what, if it wasn't Holbrooke, somebody else was asking the Pakistani government to do.
Well, it's been suggested that although he probably won't be able to rebuild his network, he still has his fingers on enough things that he could sell on his own or through some surrogates to cause real damage.
Yeah, no, I believe so. And I think that's why it's really a bad idea to give him his freedom. And it sends a very bad signal. I mean, it just says crime pays. And the more, in a sense, it's ironic. And you know, the more famous you are in Pakistan, the more of a hero you've been, the more able you are to pursue a criminal life and get away with it. And so, I think this is very troubling on many levels. And it, unfortunately, you know, you have to expect that other Pakistanis with valuable nuclear weapons related information or asset or equipment, maybe even nuclear explosive material, will seek to exploit that system and sell that to another person or a country.
Now, we have about a minute left, but I wanted to point out that your organization recently released a report about Pakistan illegally obtaining missile and drone materials using a circuitous route, including multiple bank accounts and front companies. So do the weapons proliferation problems in Pakistan extend beyond its nuclear program?
Well, it does, and they use very elaborate methods to go out and get the items they need, and they're always willing to sacrifice, you know, some kind of unwitting, I don't want to call him a fool, but unwilling businessman or woman in Europe who thinks they can make a quick buck by evading German laws or Spanish laws. And so, you know, they're quite active in this smuggling, and it's all based in Pakistan. Now, from the point of view of proliferation, you certainly do worry about missiles and other things, but the principal issue really is nuclear. That's the set of items that can cause us the most damage and our allies the most damage.
Do we have much power here? Because we have been Holbrooke asked the president and prime minister to expedite another U.S. aid package. The need to and the importance of enhanced cooperation in defense and intelligence sharing, especially in regard to Afghanistan and the Taliban. We need them probably more than they need us right now, don't they?
Well, Khan is not in their interest either. I mean, in fact, the U.S. government often in the last 30 years has downplayed the risk of Khan and the Pakistani nuclear program, and unfortunately, it doesn't get better. And the United States made a decision in the late 70s, early 80s. Well, we'll tolerate Pakistan's nuclear weapons, or at least we won't actively try to stop it or do something to really try to stop it because Russia invaded Afghanistan, and we need Pakistan for that. But unfortunately, history has shown that the risk from Pakistan's nuclear weapons doesn't get less. It gets worse. And so it's really about time that the United States realize and act that this is a serious threat, and it's going to be a threat that will last longer than the situation in Afghanistan.
David Albright, thank you so much for being with us. David Albright is president of the Institute for Science and International Security, a former nuclear weapons inspector.